this right there. This is Regina Kong with the Hobbit Hole Oral History Project. Today I'm with Molly Kemp on June 22nd, 2019 in Fred's house at the Hobbit Hole. So let's start. Could you just restate your name for me and tell me a little bit about where you were born? We'll start there.
Okay, well, it's my name is Molly Kemp. I was born in Michigan's Upper Peninsula in the little town of Sault Ste. Marie there. And was always drawn to Alaska, and here I am. I was, do you want to
Well, I feel like you said I was drawn to Alaska, and here I am. There's a lot of things in between there.
How much of, I guess what I was trying to think, I should have thought through, how much about me do you want to know versus just as it relates to the Hobbit Hole?
I'm first and foremostly interested in you, because you are part of the Hobbit Hole.
Brief encapsulation. So I grew up in the UP, which is a pretty remote, you know, sparsely populated place. My dad was taught geology at a small university there, and always sort of, though he had great physical limitations, he really loved outdoor activities and always talked about his dreams of, you know, having a homestead somewhere in the remote wilds. I think that caught me.
Oh. Hi.
Sorry. It's okay.
I think just continue on.
Okay.
Next time I'll put a sign up there.
Okay, so you're still on there.
It's still on, yeah.
Anyway, so just through a variety of family connections, I wound up in Alaska. I was a precocious kid, probably a little bit too precocious for my own good, and I thought I knew the world was on a path that I still think it's on, but I wanted to have a wilderness, self-sufficient life, at least as a base of safety and home. And that was an era where I think there was more of a feeling that there was still wilderness in the world, which we kind of have lost, I think, as the human population has continued to grow. But I wound up in Alaska through family connections and fell very crazy in love with a young man and his family, and they had homesteaded after World War II, rather. So we kind of wanted to repeat that experience through a lot of irrelevant connections ended up in this little town of Tenneke Springs.
What do you mean by you felt that the world was on a path?
Intrigued
by that.
I think I read The Population Bomb when I was in high school. And that was one of the things that made me think, you know, that too many people. And at that time, it didn't really dawn on me that the moral choice was to try to do something about for the world at large, rather than just go off into your own, what there still seemed to be remote and safe places where you could live a life that was not harming the overall picture, but wasn't necessarily doing any good either. I just, for your own self, I think that's the thing that struck me about the cohort of young people that Zach has gathered around him. Same like a lot of the kids who grew up in Alaska who go off and they come back. And they're not as selfish as I was. They want to make the world better for all. And, you know, just kind of skipping to the reasons I ended up here. Mm-hmm. So my friend Abe and I and numbers of our family and friends ended up in Tenneke Springs and started this whole dream of the self-sufficient. Had a piece of land on a old mink farm, similar to this fox farm situation, and building a log cabin, and starting a gardening, and all those good things. And my friend perished in a kayaking accident in the second year we were there, along with my other friends. And again, with the benefit of years, I can say maybe not the smartest thing, but I decided to just stay there. I was not going to be pried away from this place So I've been there ever since. But it sort of shifted from to being kind of rough go for times, just, you know, dealing with the physical realities and financial realities and having foregone my educational opportunities to have this world that I wanted more than anything else.
So how old were you when you came here?
When I went to Tanaki, I was 19. I left Michigan when I was 17. I finished high school early, and I had, as I said, I had significant opportunities that I passed up because I wanted this life more than anything else at the time. I wanted at least to get it grounded in it. I had been to Alaska once before and kind of made these connections and made that decision. Anyway, so there I was in Tanaki. His family was incredibly good to me. They, you know, transferred the property to me. They helped me put a roof on the cabin. And they were like, you know, do what you're going to do. And in the course of trying to survive there, and I got started fishing. I was fishing with this wonderful old man in Tanaki who I still miss daily. His name was Don McGee. He had a ragged old hand troller that we fooled around with. We never made any money at all, but I had it in my mind at that point, okay, this is what I'll do. I will be, and at that time it wasn't that common to have women on fishing boats. This is 40, this would be like 1978, 79, in that period of time. And so I started looking for a job as a deckhand on a real boat that actually made money, on a real troller. And I was just thinking about this as I was walking up here. I heard about the Hobbit Hole, that there were trollers based out of here, and that there were these two brothers, you know, and I heard that they, one of them, you know, needed a deckhand, but they didn't want to hire women. And I'm like, really? And I just, I can't believe I did this now, but I wrote this really snarky letter to, to people I'd never met. It's like, well, I hear you don't hire women. Well, let me tell you a thing or two about what you're missing by not hiring women. I can't imagine what they did with the other letter, because, of course, they were completely enthralled with having women. It's a great combination. And Fred wrote back to me saying, I don't know where you got that idea, but you're so wrong. And he already had somebody for the summer. But he said, if you want to go out Fish Kings with me, do that. And he actually stopped by. He had a beautiful boat. At that point, the boat he had just finished with some of the same notions that we all had at that time, that the big crunch was coming. And
what does that mean, the big crunch?
All the energy, you know, all the things of, I think, that we're still seeing in the future. They just haven't happened yet. That, you know, there was a big petroleum shortage and a big price spike. So he had built a beautiful sailing troller, and which proved to be, since the world didn't fall apart right then, not as practical as needed to really make a living at the trolling industry at that as it existed right then. Anyway, so I ended up here. And I got out here by catching a ride from Tanaki on a friend's, who was a troller, fishing boat. And I fell asleep, and I remember waking up just coming through the passes here at Teddy Dolphin Cove, and the, you know, you've seen the view now, what it was of the mountains. It's like, this is the center of the universe. It's just such a fantastic place. I was completely smitten from the moment I set foot here.
Could you describe what it looked like to you?
Well, you have to first realize I came from very flat country, so experiencing mountains in the first place was hugely important to me, or amazing. But where I live in Tanaki is, you know, it's mountainous, but it's not the big snow-capped peaks. So coming out through the pass, you see that big snow-covered, grandiose view, and all the water of Southeast Alaska comes charging in and out. There's so much life. There's fish everywhere. You know, it's just, it is. And then the coziness of the cove, of the actual Hobbit Hole Cove, and still the ability to walk out and see the big ocean out there. It's just nothing, no place like it. It's really neat. And then the atmosphere of the time then was pretty uniquely wonderful, very welcoming, kindly, accepting. Crazy stuff going on, but a lot of hard work too. And
what were some things that happened?
Oh, it's a long time ago. A really long time ago. I'd have to rummage around in my memory more. I think they were actually starting work on the hydro at that period. And there was just like communal dinner every night, and just any, willing to jump in and do whatever needed to be done was great. And then the fishing experience, of course, was really different being on the big ocean because of the swell. And, you know, it's a different experience than inside waters where you don't have that big ocean swell. And I think Fred and his brother Greg are both pretty unique characters. Funny in different ways, but at heart, very both incredibly kind.
What was your relationship people. Like to both of them, or each of them?
With Fred, I felt immediate sort of kinship. You know, it's not a small thing to go on a boat with a man you don't know. As a woman, you know, at 20. What was I then? 22, 23, something like that. And it was just so comfortable. He was just instantly okay. It's all okay. Mm-hmm. I, at that point, you know, through a whole another series of events which have nothing to do with this, I had already latched onto Nick as as a potential, but he was a potential long time association. But he was up in Kennecott for the summer, Kennecott McCarthy area, where I don't know if, what he's told you about that place, but there was a whole series of calamities there that I was involved with potentially, peripherally. So. And so we were all kind of in recovery from that, but he was destined to come back. So I mean, I've said this many times, that if I had not already made this commitment to Tanaki and that piece of ground where I was going to stick and had this anticipated romance in my life, all those things, those guys would never have pried me out of here. I would have been the cook, dishwasher, deckhand forever. It was just such a cool place. So anyway, back to the Hobbit Hole and what happened there. So I fished with Fred that little bit, had a great time. We've just been friends ever since. And as you get to know Fred, you will find out that there is just like this endless list of friends of Fred's who were mostly women who were deckhand for, you know, season, two seasons, three seasons, and have been lifelong friends. He's just a great guy.
What was the actual work like being a deckhand? What did a day look like for you?
Well, Fred at that point was already pretty structured in his day. He's a pretty creature habit. So you get up. Well, among the things he likes is movement alone by himself. So he get up at daybreak in the summer. That's like 2 or 3. And my get up call is that when the anchor comes coming into the boat, you know, because you'd anchor places out on the coast. You don't come back. At that point, he wasn't coming back every night, which he did as he got older. And I would cook because he liked that, and I didn't have any objection to that. But it's just a day of driving around in a boat and working the gear from the back pit. You need to go out and experience it. Mm-hmm. It's harder to explain than to just for you to see. But you're running the trolling wire in and out of the water, pulling out the fish on their individual leaders as they come up, clobbering the poor fish and cleaning them and storing them away for sale.
And you knew how to do all this?
I had learned the basics from the old fellow in Tanaki that I hung out with, although it was very different on Don McGee's boat. It was a hand crank. You have to do all the pulling with biceps of steel. but this gear is power gear, so there's a hydraulic reel that's pulling in the wire. Then you have four lines instead of two. So it was quite a bit of learning to do. And Fred's a very patient, kindly teacher in that he'd say, well, you messed it up, you'll have to deal with it.
Did you ever mess it up?
Oh, yeah, all the time. But, you know, he took it all very calmly. I think that's the thing that you can get any number of descriptions of types of people, you know, generalizations. There are fishermen who are called screamers, you know, the
screamers.
Like the captain of the ship expresses himself through ranting and raving and screaming at his crew. This is the opposite end of the spectrum of, you know, general kindliness. I will tell you, the one story I always tell about Fred is I think it just reveals so much about not just Fred, but the kind of the spirit of this place. We were in Glacier Bay back when you could still fish in Glacier Bay. And this is his beautiful new boat. And literally he'd spent his, I don't know how many years building the Dryas. It was not the first year fishing it, but it actually might have been the first year he was fishing the Dryas, or maybe the second year. And it cost him a lot personally and financially to do this. So just to set the stage that things went wrong, you'd think he might get a little upset about potential harm to his wonderful boat. Anyway, so we're up in Glacier Bay really early in the morning. We've already, you know, we've done the early get up. We've already had to deal with a problem that his brother Greg had. He was on the Quest, I think, at that point. And he, Akita? I don't remember what the name of his boat was. Don't tell him, I can't remember. Anyway, his fishing broke down, and his engine broke down. He didn't know what this problem was, so we went and got a line of his boat, you know, starting to tow it back to Hobbit Hole. So this is all happening, you know, before by five, and now it's time for breakfast. So I'm cooking breakfast. Fred asked me to come up and drive the boat while he goes below on our boat, but we're towing Greg behind us. And I learned a lesson there. Never take the wheel without knowing where the heck you are. Anyway, I can stop if she wants to come in. It's okay. Anyway, so I just, you know, came up from below and hit the wheel. He went below, and within 20 seconds, there's a horrible noise. I look around. We're on a rock. I mean, this is like the worst of all possible things to happen. We have actually plowed right onto a rock. The other boat is coming up behind us, you know, doesn't have power. It's just being towed by us, so it's just going along. I was just dumbfounded. Fred came flying up, you know, and we started doing what we could think of. Greg steered off. The first thought we had was to bail all the ice out of the boat. We didn't know at that point if we put a hole in the boat, if we damaged his, you know, the hull irreversibly, you know, whether the tide was going in or going out. Are we going to fall over when the tide goes out? That's the class, you know, that's the worst of all world is when you are aground and then the tide drops and you fall over and do more damage. So all of that was on the table. You'd think a person might get a little upset at that point. And Fred says to me, he said, "Stop." He said, "I want you to remember, no matter what happens, this wasn't your fault." And I was like, "Whoa." This is a really unusual person. It was really great. And, you know, tide was coming in. We lifted off. There was no damage done. We found that out. We got back. Greg was able to steer off. Well, there were a couple other things that were just so funny in retrospect. Like, in the moment, again, where we don't know what's happening, and I'm trying to shovel the ice out of he had slush tanks. I'm trying to get the weight out of there, and Greg is yelling one thing, and Fred's yelling another, and I remember Greg saying, "Are you getting enough directions right now?" That was pretty good too. But then the icing on the cake where that story was, from my personal perspective as a kind of into self-abuse mentally, you know, anything that goes wrong and you have to post-mortem and go over. And so as we get it together, everything's okay. Greg manages to steer off. We float the Dryas floats off. We get underway again. And my feeling is, okay, then now is where we start examining this story. Recriminations and guilt starts to pile up. And they get on the radio. I don't remember who was talking to, but one says, "I can't believe I forgot about that rock." And there says, "Yeah, me either. Oh well, straightforward fuck up." It's like, that's a new and novel approach to the mistakes. You make them, and then you go on, you know?
It's cool. Have you met many people like Fred around here?
To a greater or lesser degree, yeah. I think this particular group of fishermen have a really good culture. I mean, I think people tend to develop cultures in little micro cultures, and this one is really good. But honestly, Don McGee, who I fished with, was quite a bit like that too.
Yeah, so how did you meet him?
Oh, he was a resident of Tanaki Springs, or the town of Tanaki Springs, when I first got there. And I didn't really get to know him until after the accident where I lost my partner. And he kind of took me in. He and his wife kind of adopted me from a distance. You know, I was out of town, and he was late 70s at that point. As I said, we went out to go fishing and do things, never making a whole lot of money, because it was the way it was, but we're just, it was a great friendship too, really good. And again, I think it has something to do with fishing, that if you react to an emergency any other way, it doesn't help. It doesn't add to the situation to get upset and angry and, you know, act out the emotions that are very normal. But if you can kind of keep your calm and equilibrium and sense of humor, it helps a lot.
And are you someone who tends to be hard on yourself?
Absolutely, yeah. It's born in the bred in the bone. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So then, let's see. So I, you know, never lost contact, but I've just gotten back here. I'd never actually fished with Fred again. But I think, no, I did one other time. I came in just to fill in, just for a lark. That's right. But I did come back when I started working for the Department of Fish and Game. I gave up my idea of having a fishing boat, partly because Nick gets seasick. Even more than I do. But we both started working for Fish and Game, which is within the research end. And I did come back out here and kind of renewed all those acquaintances as a observer at one point, where I'd be on the boat collecting data about the fish that were coming in over the side, and how, you know, what species and sex, and collecting measurements at that time. So I got to actually go out and fish with most of the people I knew. So I made that a condition of my who I would go with, is that I had either know them personally or have the Fred seal of approval.
Are there certain people that you enjoyed fishing more
with? I didn't have any bad experiences with that. There was one boat that was so tiny I had to sit cross-legged on the hatch all day, but it was still good. It was fun.
So was with the Department of Fish and Game, was your job to like observe?
Mm-hmm. Theoretically, but I helped with the space. Mm-hmm. People let me fit. Run the gear and stuff too, which I wasn't supposed to do, but it gets pretty tedious just sitting there taking notes, and there's always so much work to do. It's helpful if you can jump in and do a little bit. So that was fun. And then Fred has a place down south that we visited off and on, and actually stayed down there for a period when Nick was going to the wooden boat school in Port Townsend. So we just kept contact over the years. And coming to the Indian Islands part of it, the institute. Well, I actually remember I was out on a sea lion research boat for Fishing Game, and we had been writing and talking to Fred about how they were coming to the conclusion they had to do something, you know, give it up, and what the future would be. And I remember talking about the what alternative was there to just another commercial fishing lodge, just another, you know, place that was made, sealed off from this big community of people that you was enjoy it.
Fred and Greg are still.
Well, they were still here for sure. Okay. This would be, and you know, the idea. Well, wouldn't this be? I mean, it came across through my mind. Wouldn't this be a wonderful place to have a field station? My mind was more on research station. Where you, you know, the idea, the sort of romantic idea of the scientists going out measuring things from here. And talked, yeah, it was talked about, but everybody that we all talked about that, and I think there was even some sort of a gathering out here, Zach might have told you about. I wasn't part of it. This was a great idea, but who's going to make that happen? We're all tired trying to retire and not start something new.
So was this idea among people who were at the Hobbit Hole during the Fred and Greg days?
Yeah, I think it was floating around for sure, and... But I don't know how, I don't actually know exactly how there was, I think it might have been through Hank Glenfer, that I think there was actually Hank and Zach somehow, was Zach even there? Anyway, there was I know there was some sort of discussion here that I, at some point, and then the idea went, well, that's a nice idea. But then somehow simultaneously, there's Zach, you know, who could do anything in the world he wanted to do, making a decision to make this his life's project. And amazingly, he has. He wrote to me out of the blue while he was still at Stanford. And of course, just saying, you know, I heard you talk, you're interested in this idea. That was, I can't remember what year that was. I was flattered by that. And then I didn't hear a thing until he wrote another email and said, would you like to be on the board of directors of this new organization? Of course, I was flattered by that too, but pretty much in over my head as far as actual bringing the kind of luster you need on your board of directors. But here I still am. So it's been great. It's been just incredible what he's accomplished. It really is. As a treasurer, that was a CD talk, he stuck me in. It's like, I've been the treasurer and secretary of our little nonprofit conservation group in Tanaki. And I was on the board of directors of a larger organization for a long time. So I know just enough to know how much I don't know. But I did bring at least a little bit of board experience to it. And I say this honestly, like every time he'd set out, now, this is what I hope to do by the end of the year in terms of fundraising and trying to work through the kind of, the very painful process of the Howes giving up their home here and what it's, and it's just agonizing for them every step of the way.
So were Fred and Greg planning on eventually selling it?
Yes.
I've always wondered about that.
I don't know. I mean, my initial vision when we started, you know, like talking on the Sea Lion Research Festival is like, well, here's the cool solution. There's a bunch of young people come and live there and Fred and Greg stay and they're the, you know, the mentors and the local knowledge and all that. And I think at that point that might have been something they would have embraced, but it just took a long time to raise all that money and work through all this. And by the time they just wanted to, you know, be done.
And they wanted to leave.
They wanted to be. And I don't think leaving was the part they wanted. It's the part of being situated someplace safe and stable. You know, age is a real thing. And the workload out here is tremendous. And there's a time we have to face up to that, hard as it is. I think they were both very relieved to kind of set aside all the responsibility of this. It's like, we were talking about that, Nick and I went and looked at the hydro, the pipe, which I hadn't looked at for years and years. It's going, oh man, what about when a tree falls on it? Then you got to come up here and fix it. And there's just so much labor that, and I think it's probably, for me, I've always said this, a place that you love so much like this, you just kind of have to walk away rather than try to be only part of it. And that, which I think I understand that better than I I would have when we were first talking about it, that to withdraw to the point of just being the, you know, the occasional helper. I think Fred might do that at some point, but I think Greg and Jane just really want to enjoy their new life and not look back, which I admire that too. This is a tough transition. I don't have to have had that in. I just know that without having to talk to them about it. This is really, I sometimes think I care more about places than people, which is a really terrible admission. But you do get, you know, you get really attached to specific places if you've lived on them for 40 years.
For you, what place would that be?
Oh, probably my home in Tenneke. You know, when I'm here, it seems a very long way away. But, you know, when we've talked about trying to leave that place, it's going to be really hard. And I've thought, I just have to walk away, take my toothbrush, and then start trying to do something new and different for a distraction. But you leave, you just kind of become part of a place.
Would you have to leave for the same reason? It's just too much to maintain?
I could definitely see that. I mean, we're not there yet, but mm-hmm. Yeah, any health issue. Like Greg has a bad ankle, you know, things catch up. They can catch up at any age, but there is an inevitability about it that you can't. Of course, my other thought, I think this is kind of, I'm really babbling, but, you know, unless you can snag the right young people that live next to you, and which is a model that's been used many times around Alaska by people in the same fix. They don't want to leave their home and they can't manage things on their own anymore. But not there yet.
So you've been in Alaska for how many years now?
40. Well, I came in 75. I guess I did spring. Yeah, 44 years.
Mm.
Yeah.
But I
haven't been here in Southeast. I was in Girdwood for a year or two before that.
Have you found that sort of what you wanted so badly when you were 19, has that lived up to what you expected?
Well, it certainly didn't play out the way I expected when we started. I think I feel mostly a sense that I could have done more. You know, I'm recognizing I could have contributed a little bit more than I have to the hopes of a better place, of reversing some of the trends that I see just accelerating right now in our society more than anywhere else in the world, probably. But but this is what it is, and on a selfish basis, there's no more wonderful place in the world left. I mean, this, Southeast Alaska is, well, probably other parts of Alaska too, but this is like the planet used to be, you know, before it was overrun with humanity. There's just so much life and abundance here. It's incomparable.
Even though this is pretty wild compared to other parts of the world, have you noticed any changes?
Tremendous, yes. Yeah.
Maybe broken your heart in some way?
Oh, yes. You know, I think it was really tough. Without getting into things that aren't relevant here too much, I was really involved in the pulp mill battles of the 80s and 90s.
What were those? I'm not familiar.
Well, to be quick, after World War, just quickly, after World War II, no, but there was a real push to get industry here and support the Japanese economy, and it was expressed through 50-year contracts that planned to have 5 pulp mills that would basically consume all the old growth timber of Southeast Alaska. There were 2 built, Ketchikan, Sitka, and they made a really good effort to do what was at the time, you know, you eradicate the old growth and get some healthy young trees growing without any recognition of what that meant to the fisheries, to the streams, to the wildlife, to the people, or even of how what a tiny fragment of the land base actually had those big trees. It's just a very unlike Washington, Oregon. They want to manage it on a 50-year rotation. Things that just don't happen here. Our trees, everything grows more slowly. It's a very different situation. Anyway, so that was a huge fight, and that consumed a lot of my time in Tanaki, trying to, again, selfishly protect the areas that we knew and cared about and depended on. And I have no idea where I was going with that.
I just asked you what sort of changes have there, like environmental
there is nothing that equals, in my mind, you know, the experience of seeing an entire valley that you never even had a chance to hike in suddenly stripped bare. That's happened to places that I was, like I say, I was new there, and I didn't understand when I first got there, because I come from a place that had already been logged and mined and everything had been done, what it meant to experience that first impact of industrial strength, clear cutting, very emotional, recognizing at the same time, you know, we're all consumers, and trying to get a balance of that has kind of been the struggle of my whole existence, trying to balance what I thought it would take in a very minimalist sense to be able to live. I don't need more than one pair of shoes, you know, or maybe a pair of rubber boots and a pair of shoes, you know. And then if we gradually get sucked more and more into consumer stuff, it's a constant juggling, balancing act.
What are some ways that you've balanced or made certain trade-offs?
Well, I mean, for personally right now, believe it or not, since I'm just talking about two float trips, one of my things that I've really come to grips with lately is it's okay not to travel. I don't have a big urge to travel. I probably wouldn't, I mean, to me it's an event to get in the kayak and go to Gustavus, to come here, and that's one of the things. But more than that, but what I feel good about is that we are trying, since we're home more now, I'm trying really hard to get our food production to be as completely self-sufficient as we can. I'll always be bringing in stuff that we crave, but we have, you know, the gardening is hugely satisfying to me, and growing things year-round is a big goal. Harvesting, I love to harvest food and process it. I don't really like cooking for people on a lunch again. You want to eat again? I mean, I don't object to it, but it's processing big amounts of berries or fish or anything like that's really gratifying if you have a chance to do it. I grow immense amounts of rhubarb and actually selling it, but I just, you know, I love the feeling of a table covered with canning jars all full and sealed.
What are some of your favorite meals to make? They're all foods that you've gathered.
Well, that's good. Depends what fad we're in at the moment, but my favorites are fish-based, or venison, vegetables from the garden. It's hard to get away from carbohydrates except through potatoes, and I like potatoes, so we eat a lot of potatoes. And that, you know, finished off with, that's where the dairy things are really hard for me to let go. Yogurt is awfully nice. but for you can certainly put a meal on the table that's 98% locally grown, with fish and potatoes and deer and potatoes and all the vegetable garden, I mean the vegetables, produce kind of stuff in the garden. Or I'm trying to do more with seaweed, which I've never really gotten into, but we've been pickling and canning and making chutney and salsa out of kelp more. That's really great. Of course, you're bringing all the spices and all that, but I accept that. It's a necessary part of it. Yeah, it's hard. Everything is, I was struck by that when I was going through that fishing gear again, and the folks who were starting to help me, they, you know, it's like, well, all this junk, we just shovel it out the door and put get rid of it. It's like, oh, no, 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 I'm not going to do that because this is old fishing gear that is, some of it is actually better than anything you can get on. Some of it is looking really rough, and I don't know if it'll ever happen. But people used to take, like, the spoons, you know, in the winter. They'd clean them up, grind them, repaint them, you know, do things because it was so hard to get things here. And I think now that it's so much easier, that's part of why we throw things away so much.
I feel like we've lost a lot with this emphasis on convenience.
Yeah.
And just, I mean, it's always about making life easier, but it makes me wonder, like, what do we lose when that happens?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's coming around now because things are getting, the dollar value is going up. You know, like the fishing gear thing is an example. Things are getting so expensive that now people are not out of any particular thoughtful moral desire. A lot of people are trying to rehabilitate stuff just because it's cheaper, and then they find out, well, it's better too because the materials are not made for, they were built to last for a long time rather than a one use and throw away. I don't know. I hope for all you guys' sake that it's not too late and we can turn this around but there's real changes. When I first went to Tanaki, again, there was before the ferry came in there, and it was such a different feeling. And I think Nick and I both talked about this a lot, that if you get a reward for being ingenious and using what's at hand, you know, the reward is you make your chainsaw work or you can fix things. There is a real satisfaction in that. That is now, Amazon will get it here in 3 days. it really takes away, it whittles away at your feeling that this is a worthwhile life to live. I think that's where, and you can just put enough money towards something and you can have anything delivered to your door, or your door built for you and your house built for you, and have everything that you would have anywhere else. And it's really unsettling in a lot of ways. It's hard to express, but it's the same. It's, well, we were talking about that this morning at the breakfast table. How about how the amazing, wonderful, extraordinary technology makes actual knowledge isn't really that valuable anymore, because you could just ask Google.
Like spelling, for instance.
Yeah, exactly. Who needs to learn to spell? Yeah, or who needs to memorize a list of species? You know, they're just, it's just all there, and we're have to rethink what is valuable. But as I always point out, if you drop your smartphone in the salt water, still really helps know whether the tide's coming or going. So we've made that mistake. We had a job where we were working streams, you know, walking streams for fish information. The biggest challenge is that with these huge tides, if you just have your little boat keeping it afloat, well, you can come in if you want. I feel bad. I'll keep you out of their house. Anyway, so we tried to make that transition because Nick found this. He had a little iPad. What is it? The iPod. One of the first things that came out had a little screen, and he discovered you could get this thing that shows the graph of the cod. That was really cool. He put it in the pocket of his waders, and then he waded over the top of his waders and filled it with salt water. Still really nice to have a tide book. And go through that mental process. There's this mental process about the rule of 12s that you can think through the sine curve and know where you are in that tide. It's like, see, there's still value. We're not completely obsolete yet.
So I wanted to ask you, what do you think when you see all these students coming in here? Like, people have never lived a week without internet.
I think it's wonderful.
Or even a day. Never chopped some wood. It's fishing.
It's great. That's the idea. I mean, that's what we want to see. And I think it's so wonderful to see people coming back here because they caught it. They got it. It's great. That was the hope, and it's happening. It's really exciting. I think I always remind myself, I think sometimes it's really humorous what you see people just astonishment and trying to grapple with things. And I think of how I respond to the urban environment in exactly the same way, just or the technological problems I have. But I think that awakening of the natural world as I've had the privilege of experiencing it, in, you know, just wildlife encounters and being in places where it's had very little human impact, is really wonderful. I think one of the girls in that first Nueva School video, it just actually made me cry, because like I say, I'm so guilt-ridden as a human being just about breathing and living. And she said coming here was the first time she had experienced nature without guilt and without being confronted with all the, you know, here's another terrible, you know, here's another loss we're facing. And here it's still so, so much life overflowing from every container. It's really inspiring, to makes you want to protect it, and that's part of the idea. And then also to feel that, you know, I don't know, we're not, how do you separate the personal sense of guilt from the realities that there are too many people, it's a hard thing. And I think it made me feel really great that this obviously brilliant young woman is going, oh, you know, there's a way to feel good about it. Because I think it makes kids shun nature if all you see and hear is gloom and doom and the world is coming to an end, whether or not it actually is. You can't care about what you don't love. You have to learn to love things before you, or have the opportunity before you can care enough to make a difference. This is all, I know, not new thoughts. But I love the kids that grow up in Tanaki. I have a couple of them just really adore. They have such a wonderful, different existence. It's much more like when I grew up, that they're free to just be outside all the time doing whatever they want. But they also are really involved in all the marine life, the intertidal life. They know, they are incredibly knowledgeable. And who knows what they'll do with it, but they really care about it. It's such a different experience than growing up and learning about these things in a book. Excuse me, Google. yeah. So it's something that everyone, you can't expect people to care about the future of these animals and ecosystems, unless they have an emotional attachment to them, which is what I hope people get here. Anyway.
Thank you so much, Molly.
I'm babbling. At this point, it's time to shut me off, or I'll start babbling all day.
That was a perfect ending.